Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 8th, 2015, and welcome to episode 113 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, basically the computers of the 70s and 80s that we loved and that we still have and still play with, no matter what you say. And I've got the cast of regulars here with me today, the irregular regulars. I guess maybe we'll go in order of latitude here. So who's more to the north, Ken or Paul? It's got to be close.
It's got to be close.
I think technically I am, Paul, because okay. I'm north of the river, right?
Okay, then Ken goes first. Ken, how are you today?
Hello, RL. This is Ken Gaddy with YouTube channel GameBits. How the heck are you?
I'm doing well, sir.
Sorry, I've been recording so many videos because the weekend is the only time I have to shoot videos, and I'm trying to record enough to get me through the whole week so I can just let my YouTube channel run itself, and I just have that intro down pat, and I wasn't even thinking that. This is the Retro Computing Roundtable. Hi.
Well, that's okay. And we don't mind shameless plugs either, by the way.
Well, I try to save them for the bottom of the show, not the top.
I see. No, that's perfect, though. So then, very close in latitude and very close in attitude, we have Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Earl. Hello, everyone. Yeah, as Ken will probably be able to attest, the weather is insane here. It can't decide if it's summer or winter or what. But pretty soon, I think we'll probably settle down to a nice frozen tundra.
And as it turns out, it's neither. It's actually fall. So yeah. Maybe it's confused. Those in-between seasons, they're pesky.
Any opportunity I can have to get on my bicycle late into the season, as late as possible, I will take it.
Yeah, we've had unseasonably warm weather here in Portland as well, continuing down the latitude chain here, I guess. And where it's actually a whole different season altogether. It's a whole different season. Is Michael Mulhern.
Hello, everybody.
How are you there, sir?
Pretty good. It's still beautiful weather here. So late spring, so been getting some more work done outside and not much work done inside.
Well, that's okay. What work have you been doing outside?
It's just some more clearing of some brush and just getting, as I said last time, just keeping the bush back from the house block and just making everything look nice, and also being spring, being taking photos of all the creatures that are crossing my path while I'm outside, so echidnas, wallabies, various birds, the occasional red-bellied black snake, and yeah, it's pretty good. Oh, yeah, and there was a big goanna, about a five-foot-long goanna that came running across the creek the other day and up a large tree. So I'm glad it went up the tree and not me.
Yes.
So wow. A goanna is something with legs.
Yeah, right? Lizard. So okay. Technically its name is a lace monitor. So
cool.
5 foot, would have been at 5 foot tip to tail.
Well,
so the front shoulders would have been about 8 inches, 10 inches across.
That is amazing. I don't live in the world of 5 foot lizards, so
that's not the big one. That's only the middle sized one. I've seen a larger one.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
I would love to talk to you about that sometime. But we can't hear because it's a retro computing podcast, but I would still like to talk to you about that sometime because Jiminy Cricket. Anyway, let's get on with the host topic. And today, gentlemen, we're going to sum it up. Even though we're podcasters and basically we get paid by the word. Wait, we don't get paid at all. Well, anyway, we like to talk, obviously, which is why we're here. But let's say that your non-retro enthusiast friend asks, why do you collect, play with, learn about these old computers? And they have the puzzled look on your face that I'm sure we've all seen. You have to answer them in 50 words or less. And that's usually a good idea because if you do any more than that, you start to see the eyes glaze over, the deer in the headlights look, the, oh my gosh, look at the time as they move off to another corner of the party. So, got to be short and sweet. And after that challenge, I'm sure we'll have some more words to say, but can you give the elevator speech on what the hobby is about, what you like about it? I'm going to go in the same order, I think. Mr. Ken Gagne, what do you say when somebody asks you this?
I mean, you can ask them, why do people collect old cars or old comic books? It's the same thing. They like tinkering. They like the nostalgia. They like so many different aspects of it. For why I personally do it, it's the community, primarily. Sure, there's nostalgia. There is the continuity of having the same machine for the entirety of my life, but for me, it's more about a way to connect with brilliant and bizarre people I would never meet any other way.
Fascinating.
You take that back.
No, I meant every word of it, especially
for you. I resemble that.
So what do you think, Paul? I think that was a good sum up, Ken. Paul, what's your excuse?
Yeah, I think this is a it's a hard question, but you know, like if I wanted someone to believe that this is kind of, you know, not just an individual craziness, I think there's learning about both art and kind of intellectual history, as well as kind of like the you know, sort of intellectual exercise of figuring things out that are complicated but still within one's grasp. You know, I think it's a lot like what would, you know, cause people to play around with electronics and so forth. You can understand the thing and make it do what you want. There are many things that these things have never done before, so you're actually doing something that's kind of new. You're sort of respecting the work, the design work that people have put into things, both the circuits and the shells, and also just sort of covering history. That's about it, and it's got to have been like 78 words.
I was going to say, you might have exceeded your elevator time. You might have taken, you know, a
Let's
couple
just go
rides
to the basement
on the elevator.
Again.
Yeah. So, Michael, how do you answer this?
Well, I normally use the classic car as sort of an example of it's not as strange as you think. But I also tell them that if I wasn't into retro computers, I'd be into hoarding. It's a little bit like that at times.
I think we're both.
But yeah, similar lines. I say that it's more of a theme. So I repair. I do my soldering. I do basic electronics. I do programming, and I do a little bit of hardware repair. So it's just a vehicle for a whole lot of different skills and hobbies all rolled into enjoying classic 8-bit computers.
Awesome.
And then a whole pile of other stuff that seems to accumulate along with it.
Well, as usual, you guys have some fantastic ideas. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking about the nostalgia, the historical value of the machines. Like you folks, I liken it to collecting old cars or collecting old timepieces, that you get the benefit of the history, you see the progression of technology. I also think there's a compelling simplicity with retro computers. You can wrap your mind around the whole thing, and that simplicity isn't a part of our day-to-day computing or technology experience today, and I enjoy that. But I love what Ken said about community. Love what Paul said about respecting the intellectual endeavor that went along with creating the machine or using it today to do new things. And I love what you said, Michael, about being able to tinker and practice some other skills. Like, I didn't even put two and two together, but it's true that electronics, soldering, troubleshooting, that sort of thing comes along with this as well. So you guys have great elevator speeches. That is very cool. I'm very encouraged. I think I'll stay with this hobby.
I have one question for you, Earl. You mentioned people who collect classic timepieces. Does that happen?
It does. In fact, I have an uncle that collects pocket wristwatches. And he has a very nice collection, some very beautiful artifacts that span different decades, and he's able to repair them and show them off, and I think it's just neat.
Okay, because when I picture somebody who collects timepieces, I think of either Dr. Emmett Brown from Back to the Future or some sort of rogue villain from The Flash.
Well, I would also think of one of the characters on Grimm, who actually is a clocksmith by trade and a strange Vesson monster by night. But in real life, people do collect timepieces. They do indeed. In fact, cuckoo clocks, that's one niche of that particular hobby. Also, grandfather clocks is another one.
Ah, so it's sort of like, it's like the handhelds versus big iron.
That's right. I have a mainframe grandfather clock here, and don't call me crazy.
You don't have a grandfather wristwatch?
No, I do not. But that would be cool, right, with the little swiveling pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, I'm going to turn it over to you for listener feedback, because I think you're the one who typed these things in.
Sure. Okay. One thing that I wanted to mention, so last time I talked about the reintroduction of Call Apple magazine, and I may not have covered all of the details quite as I intended to, but it's produced in PDF form, so it's not a print magazine, but it is still a subscription type service. I mean, like, it's, you don't exactly subscribe to Call Apple the magazine. It's just one of the perks that you get from being in the user group. So there's the new Call Apple magazine issues, but there are also a number of other things that they do, and you have access to their old archives and old software as well as a member. So it's a PDF, but it's not, you know, it's still kind of curated and controlled. And the other thing that I did sort of make it sound a little bit like it's sort of old news, because it was the first one after kind of a hiatus, but it's true that everything that is in the magazine is newly written for it. So it's not like it was on the website or available in other places. And, you know, some of the things that they're talking about, other people have talked about as well. But they also have things like a discussion of Paul Lutus's Space Raiders game and the impact that had and so forth. And, you know, so it's great that it's back, and it will be interesting to see where it goes.
So Call Apple good.
Yes, Call Apple good. My lack of clarity, bad. But other things we got. So Tony sent a link, among other links, to a YouTube video of a basically like 3D modeled flyover that goes outside and then deep inside an Atari 800XL. And so if you haven't seen it, it is really interesting to look at. Just sort of describing it doesn't quite give you the effect. It's really quite something. It's just like you were flying around in there. I want one of these to exist for every computer I have.
That video is amazing. I can't even imagine how much work it took to create that detailed 3D model. Once you get the 3D model in place, then actually doing the fly around isn't so tough. But boy, the beauty that went into that model, and it looked really good too. It was virtually, if not truly, photorealistic, don't you think?
Yeah. Definitely. The writing was on the top of all the chips. The resistors had all their little colored bands. You know, it was really, really quite something. I kind of want to have, you know, like, I mean, I guess I don't know the sort of current games, but you know, like a Doom level in there would be kind of cool.
That would be cool. Yeah.
But and I also made me wonder if maybe the modeling work that Charles Mangan has done could be you know, if you could take those models and instead of 3D printing them, you know, put your little camera in there and walk around. Anyway, very cool thing to see. Tony mentioned that he saw a typo on one of the last, one of the logic chips at the end, that where it said Singapore instead of Singapore. So was curious to know if the original had that, if there is a typo in some people's Ataris, Atari 800 XLs as well. I have no idea.
Well, it's too bad we don't have Jack here. He could research that for us. Maybe one of the Antic folks can tell us. One of you guys who have an Atari 800 XL, let us know if one of the chips came from Singapore.
Right. And I guess the last one I'll mention, we got a number of things in feedback, but I'll stick with these three. So Cody sent us a link to a series of YouTube videos called The State of Electronics, which covered the electronics scene in Australia. So it's not really computer related. It's definitely electronics related, but it's a huge number of short interviews. Among them are Dave Jones of the EEV blog and Dick Smith, of the Dick Smith Enterprises, and many others. So we'll link to a trailer, but there's the channel that the trailer's in has a whole lot of interviews, and I must say I've only seen a little bit. I watched the trailer, but so Michael, is this at all familiar to you?
Some of those clips are familiar. Dick Smith is one of my heroes, both within the computing and electronics field where he started, but he's also a very well-known philanthropist and adventurer as well. So a very interesting chap that he is.
And the Dave Jones of the EEV blog is just a real hoot. If you're interested in electronics, you want to see some fascinating teardowns and you want to understand how some of the electronics equipment works, like test equipment and that kind of thing, that's a great video blog. I really enjoy it. So, on to the items of interest. I guess we'll leave this one for Carrington to talk about next time, but we do want to let you guys know that the basic computer language has come to the Nintendo 3DS. It's a really interesting implementation. So, Carrington, next time you're with us, why don't you chat about that? But in the meantime, we will have a link up in the show notes. And I'm going to jump to my first item of interest here. I got a couple of programming items to talk about this time around. This is on a language that I never heard of, and I can't believe that there's actually an old computer language that I didn't come across at some point. This is called XPL0, which I guess as it stood for Experimental Programming Language 0. It's been around for decades. It's currently still actually being worked on. It's available for the Raspberry Pi. You can get a DOS version of it. And now they've recovered a CPM version, thanks to some great digital archaeology that's going on here. This XPL0, it's a block-structured language. They describe it as a mix between Pascal and C. If you want more information on this language, maybe you've never heard of it either, you can go to www.xpl0.org. That link will be up in the show notes. I'm going to be downloading and checking it out. I think I'll run it on the Raspberry Pi. They said that they recently did some optimizations and you can do some cool, fast animations with it. So, woohoo. Huh.
Cool. I had never heard of that now.
Yeah, have any of you guys ever heard of XPL0?
I've not, no.
Not until this moment.
Huh. Just language that was off in the corner somewhere. It'd be fascinating to find out some of the history of it and where it sits in the family tree of languages. So, Ken, what have you got for us on Coleco?
Coleco, this is a video game system that I did not exactly grow up with, but my cousin had one, and I thought it was really cool because it was so foreign to me having just the Atari 2600 and 5200. Coleco, of course, is I don't know if you call it an abbreviation or an acronym, but it was originally the Connecticut Leather Company, and the two products that they are most famous for, in my opinion, are the ColecoVision cartridge-based video game system and Cabbage Patch Kids. I did not have either of those as a kid. So this is fascinating to me because it's something I don't know much about, and there is currently a Kickstarter for the complete history of Coleco. Not ColecoVision, but Coleco, the company. This is currently on Kickstarter, and they are asking for $5,500 Canadian, and they have, at the time of this recording, they're about $100 short of doubling that goal. They've already raised almost $11,000 Canadian from 167 backers, and they still have 21 days to go. So this will be a hardcover book. They have reached that stretch goal to have it in hardcover. There will be both English and French editions, since this company is based out of Canada, and they are hoping to have it available by sometime in spring of 2016. So that is June of 2016. Now, this project is being run by the co-founder of the website retrogamer.ca. So he has a storied history in the retro gaming scene. However, the company that he has founded to publish this, I believe they are calling themselves Book, B-O-O-Q-C. That's clever because QC is Quebec. They, as far as I can tell, do not have a website or a Facebook page or a portfolio or a catalog. They are hoping that this book will be their first in a series of books about the history of video game consoles and companies. So this is an ambitious outing, and they have already achieved their funding, which is great, and I can see that several of my friends from the retro gaming community, as well as myself, have all already backed this project, so we will get a copy when and if it eventually arrives. I'm excited about it. This is a great time for Kickstarter to be releasing books and documentaries about old game systems. There have been several about different computers in the past few years, and you know, what's one more? Let's get some Coleco books out there. Have any of you seen this Kickstarter yet?
I have not.
Yeah, I saw the Kickstarter fly through, but I've only got it pinned. I haven't gone in to have a close look, but definitely sounds like something I'd be interested in getting.
Yeah, me too. And I think that it's very encouraging that they've not just blown through their original goal, but almost all of their stretch goals. There's one more stretch goal, and they've got 21 more days to get there. And I think it's really conceivable that they'll get there, actually. And the final stretch goal that they want to get to here, they say, let's be crazy. If we reach that goal, we'll go to Hartford, Connecticut to do some research directly on site from where Coleco actually was, which would be awesome if they could add that to the portfolio of this book that they're putting together.
As somebody who has been born and raised and living in New England, it's kind of funny to me that a stretch goal is going to Connecticut. Like, ooh, so exotic. How exciting. Let's raise money for that. But they do say that they already have some interviews lined up or conducted, including with Michael Katz, for example, the very first VP of Coleco, as well as a company called Collector Vision, which I guess has their fingers in Coleco stock or hardware as well. And they are lining up some other interviews, including with Janelle Jacques, who, of course, was at this most recent Kansas Fest with Burger Becky.
Excellent. I hope they have a chance to cover the Coleco Atom as part of all this. I guess if it's the complete history, then one might assume it would be in there.
Well, one line item in their project description says there will be new photography of the ColecoVision and Atom computer, their hardware, and many prototypes never seen before.
Excellent. This is a good find, Ken. If this is something that you're interested in, I'd encourage folks to run over and back this Kickstarter.
Yeah, and one thing to note is when I backed it, I thought I was pledging $25 plus $10 shipping to get the paperback version of the book, which I guess will now be hardcover because they reached their stretch goal for everybody. I didn't realize that the $35 I was pledging was Canadian, because now when I go to the project, it says, you pledged $35, and then in fine print it says, that's about $27 USD.
Yeah.
Which is strange to me, because at the top of the page it says their goal is $8,225 USD. So that is by default United States dollars, and then the amount I pledged is listed in Canadian. So it's not very consistent, but long story short, I saved $8. Yay.
Awesome. And supported a worthwhile project. Good on you.
Yay.
So, Michael, Lego meets Babbage. You know, I don't think that they ever actually coexisted.
Well, they should have. this was an interesting item that came through one of my other interest feeds. Bit of a Lego nut here myself. But we'll link to a page here called Building Complex Machines Using Lego. And this is a working hand-cranked difference engine made using Lego pieces. So there's some great photos in here, some backstory. There's a YouTube video of it in action and calculating. And then for those of us, myself included, who weren't really paying attention in maths class as much as they should have, there's a very well laid out section on how does a difference engine compute. So if you've always wondered exactly what Babbage's difference engine did and how it did it, well, this is a great link as well, even if you're not overly interested in Lego. But who's not interested in Lego, especially when you look at the mechanical issues that they had to address to actually create this engine using their goal of standard Lego parts and the fact that it's plastic, it's not metal, there's lots of movement. There's trying to optimize horizontal and vertical axes to move everything, and it is a beautiful, beautiful machine.
I really don't have any words to describe how awesome this is. I wish that there was a kit form of this, if that doesn't exist, or at least a bill of materials that you could take to a school, for instance, and let one of your class projects in technology and computing be to build one of these difference engines with Legos. I could just see that being an amazingly informative and fun class project, and would, like you say, Michael, tell you some things about math and also some things about the dawn of computing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Just to think that, well, first of all, it's a very complicated looking machine when you're done with it. But the fact that it can count and do math and stuff, I mean, that's just without any no electricity is just sort of astounding.
Yeah, it's that is one of the things which I've always found interesting with the analytical engines is that the computational devices, no electricity, no electronic parts, it's all mechanical gears and timings. It's the actual real machines that have been made have always enthralled me. But to actually see that someone has taken the time and effort to reduce that down to being able to do it in Lego parts is truly, truly amazing.
Do you guys know if anyone has ever done a difference engine or an analytical engine type simulation in Minecraft or in some sort of other 3D modeling world?
I don't know of such a thing, but that seems, now that you say it, like a fairly obvious project to do.
Seems like it would be fun, because that way you could see it, at least a simulation of it, in motion.
Yeah.
I've never actually played Minecraft, but I know Dr. Steve Weirich is quite the aficionado. We should ask him.
Yeah. Every time I just manage to just, like, dig holes down and get trapped. Like, I can't move at all. I don't know what I'm doing.
That's pretty close to my Minecraft level of sophistication also. My son helps me.
There was a sort of related link that I stuck in here in the show notes. I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but are you familiar with the Lego Ideas site
Yes, I love the Lego's Ideas site. But yeah, I agree. We've got a link in here for our listeners, and you'll be able to see some historical computers in as Lego models, and they're actually quite well constructed, these. I've actually got the official Lego mini computer programmer. And
oh my gosh, look at the cray.
Yes.
Yeah, isn't that cool? So these are, from what I understand, Lego's been doing this for a while, but if you have an idea for a Lego set, you can model it and put it up on the Lego Ideas site and basically try to get support for it. And if you hit 10,000 supporters, then LEGO will review it and possibly actually make the set. So this is not a set that exists, but so far they have 217 supporters out of 10,000 that they need just for review. But there is about a year left, so it's cool to look at. You know, it's not going to be for this year's holidays that you'll be able to get these for people, but it would be neat if these came to exist. There's a little cray, there's a couple of personal computers. There's a big sort of IBM-esque tape unit and a bunch of other things.
A non-working difference engine.
Right. Yeah.
And Michael's right. Who doesn't love Lego? Lego's awesome. Moving on to something a little more somber. Paul, you have some sad news for us.
Yeah, so it was just sort of recently reported that Chuck Forsberg passed away on September 24th this year. Now, I did not actually know the name prior to hearing about this, but Chuck Forsberg was, you know, so sort of one of the main things that we would know him for is the design of the Z-modem protocol. So back in the early days of transmission, you know, there were various ways that one would try to get the data across the wires, and X-modem was one of the sort of early ways that this was done, and, you know, bundling up the data into little packets and sending those across and trying to do at least a kind of error checking. But there were various problems with X-modem, and Y-modem tried to address some of these, and there was Kermit. There were a number of different protocols, but I think Z-modem came along at enough of a right time that it could sort of see where all these other protocols were falling down and actually, you know, try to solve all these problems. So among the things that it could do, you could, like the sender could start the transfer and, you know, do things without interaction. It did cyclic redundancy checks on the data so that it would make sure the data came across safely. It had a better sort of flow control. It had a lot of stuff that really made Z-modem just the reliable way to send data. I mean, like, certainly almost all of my modem transfers once we got sort of past the late 80s, I guess, was in Z-modem, and it was great. So it was a major contribution to the world, but there's quite a nice sort of obituary that we'll link to that talks through various aspects of, you know, things that he did in his life. The 1984 was when Omen Technology was founded, basically in order to kind of give Z-modem a home. So does anyone else have, you know, Z-modem recollections?
I use Z-modem extensively, and this just reminds me how many unsung heroes there actually are in the computing world. I, like you, Paul, was not familiar with the name Chuck Forsberg. He, it turns out, actually lived here in Portland, I guess, based on the obituary that I'm reading. But the protocol that he invented here, Z-modem, helped me a lot during the modem days, all the way up to and including some of the first internet links where you would have a shell account with something like Netcom or whoever you were with, but the transfer mechanism back and forth from your shell account would use the Z-modem protocol. I'm glad that we have this opportunity to celebrate the contribution that he made, and you're right that the obituary that we're going to link to is a good summary.
By the way, if anybody wants some more insight into early modem transmission protocols, I spent hours as a kid just poring over the pages of the ProTerm 3 manual. This thing was a behemoth, over 300 pages detailing how all the different protocols work, as well as the features of the software. A PDF of it is available from the Lost Classics Project, as well as the Internet Archive. If you do a Google search for either ProTerm manual or ProTerm 3 manual, you'll find this document. It's a really, really exhaustive and mentions Chuck Forsberg in pages, let's see, 256 and 257.
Okay.
Ah,
nice.
Fantastic. Wow. And that was a manual for a piece of software, but it covered the protocols that it used in some detail, huh?
Yeah, this was created by Greg Schaefer and published by Jerry Klein of Intrek Software, and it was the premier 8-bit telecom program, in my opinion, because it's the one I use, so of course it was premier, not vice versa. And yeah, I highly recommend it as a old-school telecom program with some great VT100 emulation and the like. And of course, you just don't get manuals like that anymore.
Right.
That's true.
Another thing that I'll link to is the, I'm not sure if it's, I have it written down as being the Z modem spec. I'm not sure if that's exactly what it is, but it's a actually quite a large document that gives kind of the history of what was wrong with other protocols and how they fixed it in Z modem and how, you know, actually if you wanted to implement it, what you would do. So that's surprisingly interesting, although I didn't make it all the way through, but you know, at least it starts out surprisingly interesting.
Excellent. Well, I'll move on to another programming topic. I warned you I had two of them. This one is on integrated development environment for 6502-based machines like the Apple II, the Commodore, the Atari. I actually found a reference to this software package, this system called WUDSN. I'm not sure how you would pronounce that, so I'm not going to try, but I found it on the Atari Age forums. And this is an Eclipse-based programming environment. It's got all the bells and whistles for 6502 programming, including syntax highlighting and your various quadrants where you can look at what your code is doing. Now, it's a little painful for me to point anyone to this because personally I'd rather have a root canal than use anything in Eclipse. But I know that Eclipse has a lot of aficionados, a lot of enthusiasts. If you're one of them, this could be worth looking at. And if you happen to be running Windows, there's a one-stop shopping installer that you can download, a zip that you just apparently download, unzip, and then run right off the bat. And I have to say, that is one of the benefits of Java-based applications. They often have a pretty light footprint on your machine. As long as you've got the right Java runtime environment, the application can just kind of load and go. Anyway, we'll have a link for this up in the show notes. Another link that we'll have that's related, there's a set of YouTube tutorials on how to program with this environment. In fact, there's two sets. The one that we'll link to is just a generic set on WDSN. The other set by the same publisher on YouTube, the same author, deal specifically with using it for Atari-based computers. So if this is something that would interest you, I think it's worth a look. Hmm. And now over to Ken. Ken, this title wins the award for brevity. It just says computer show.
Oh, I know what he's talking about.
Yes, well, this is not a reference to something else. That is actually the name of it. And this is, in a way, old news. Carrington actually tweeted it a while ago, and it's been posted to Facebook a couple of times, including by Mr. Sean Fahey. And the reason I think most people aren't talking about it, as far as I know, it hasn't been on the show on RCR yet, is because I don't think they find it as funny as I do. I thought it was a riot. So you all remember the old TV show Computer Chronicles, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It was on PBS, I think, hosted by Seifert. And so that show was great. It introduced people to new technology and the personalities behind them, including Mr. Bill Budge, back when computers were still fairly new. And a lot of, maybe, I don't know this for sure, but it seems like maybe some media outlets just wanted to brush it off as a fad, or when they wrote about it, they didn't know what they were talking about. Like, oh, I don't have anything else to report on today. I'll go write an article about the internet. Well, Computer Chronicles actually dove into this stuff much more in depth, and it was on the show for literally decades. Hasn't been on the air now for decades, but Computer Show, which can be found online at computer.show, brilliant URL, is sort of a parody of that. It has a male host who represents like the height of technological awareness circa 1983, and he is interviewing people from modern day Silicon Valley. And so there's like 25 years gap in knowledge between the two parties on opposite sides of the table. Like one person is saying, well, you just go to your website, and the host is like, so a website, that's like someplace I drive to in my car and I give them my floppy disk. And the guy, and like they have like the founder of Reddit, and he's like, yeah, sure. And he just goes on like nothing's happening. And it's just, it's so incredibly awkward. And not only that gulf of understanding, but also the main character, you know, like he has a chip on his shoulder about some things. He's carrying some guilt, and there's some backstory there that he just comes across incredibly awkwardly. Like somebody tries to introduce him to online dating. He's like, oh, it's like, can you use this to find me like a cute blonde about 5'4" named Lisa who likes to play tennis? Like, I think it's really awkward and really fun. Like, I feel like I'm laughing at the character, not with him, and I love it.
Yeah,
so yeah, check
really
out Computer Show. There are only 2 episodes, which is really frustrating because it deserves more. But if they were just trying to get their point across,
they're
then
only
I guess
from 3 weeks ago, so there might be more.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, they have. I think the topics that they've covered so far are arts and communities, which are and they have like the people on the other side of the table. They're guests for each episode. They're not playing characters. I mean, they are reading off a script, but these are people playing themselves. Like if they say they are CEO of so and so, they really are the CEO of that modern day company, which is pretty cool. One thing I don't like, and this is a pet peeve, this video series is created by Sandwich Video, and they do a lot of commercials for tech products like LastPass, the password management system, or Coin, which is a credit card successor, I guess. And almost every single one of the videos made by Sandwich Video, the founder of the company, Adam Lissiger, appears. And I'm just getting so sick of seeing him in everything, because this isn't like Stan Lee, who makes like shows up like once or twice a year, or Alfred Hitchcock, who like created these masterworks with brief cameos. Like Adam Lissiger usually is the star of every commercial everywhere on the internet, and I'm getting so sick of seeing him. Not because his videos are bad, but because is he like a replicant? Is he a clone? What is going on? I don't need him pitching everything to me. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah. I guess I always thought of him as the creative behind this particular thing. I mean, like, I thought this computer show was actually his. So I don't see him elsewhere.
Apparently, everything is his.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, okay, I now know what I'm going to be watching right after we record this podcast, because yep. I just love this kind of humor, this quirky. That's my thing. And I think for a lot of tech people, that actually is their thing. If stuff like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is any indication. So, all right. Well, now, gang, we're going to stop being physical. We're going to start being virtual. We've actually got a couple of virtual things. If you can't afford to either own or go find the real thing, then... And we'll start with Key Punch. Michael?
Okay, over at Messwork, they've got a virtual key punch machine. So, yes, you pop on over and you punch up a key card. So, very simple to do. And, why would you want to do that? Well, why not? But there's a companion link there, which I found even more interesting, is they have a virtual card reader. So, if you've got a box of cards from your earlier computing days, and I'm sure I've got a couple of boxes of my Fortran programs from university lurking in the back of the storage here somewhere. It says that you can take an image of your card, drop it onto the virtual card reader, and then it will read it for you. So interesting and some less than interesting Fortran programs back from the mid-80s that early 80s, mid-80s that I would like to see again, because I can't seem to find the actual listings. I used to have a listing of every program that I had actually done at university, but I just can't seem to find it, and I managed to lose it before I was able to scan these sorts of things. But any experience, guys, in programming via your punch machines?
Oh, that's how I got started. I was doing Fortran, and it was both punch and also Mark Sense cards, where you use a number 2 pencil.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, that's I started with the Mark Sense cards as well, and remember taking those down to the operator window and putting the deck in, and just sitting over to the side in the foyer area to the operator's window was a IBM card punch, and I asked, could we use that? And they said, yeah, if you know how to use it, go for it. And most people then just sort of like went away and went, oh, I don't know how to use that. And amazing thing, the university library, you'll find a manual for everything. So I quickly taught myself how to use the punch machine, and that made programming so much easier than sitting down with the 2B pencil and marking up the cards.
Indeed.
And Fortran needs all the help it can get.
And it's nice in this case that they have a virtual card reader. I hadn't seen that before. I've seen quite a bit of the work that they've done over at masswerk.at. I love that site. But this card reader is something new to me and something I've got to try.
And actually possibly useful.
Yeah, I've got to find some of my punch cards. It's very useful. It'd be much easier to just sort of like take some photos of the punch cards than just crop and drop them onto the reader plate. And quite useful. Otherwise, I've got maybe two cartons of programs sitting in a box in storage somewhere, and I'd just like to sort of go back and have a look at some of those programming exercises and assignments that I did.
It appears that this is the work of Norbert Landsteiner, pretty much solo, and it's amazing. So definitely look at everything that is under this site.
Yep. And at the bottom of the article at the website there's actually PDFs of the IBM card punch machine manual, so that brought back some memories.
Continuing in the if you can't have it, then simulate it, Paul, you've got a PDP-8 simulator that you want to talk about here. But before you do, you actually have a hardware PDP-8 simulator that you should be building, young man.
I know. I'm sorry. Michael
but
has one, too.
Tell us about the simulator.
Yeah. Paul, how many times have you opened the box and then looked at it and thought about it, then closed the box? And
I'm really looking forward to doing it, but I just have to set aside. I have to find, like, a day that I have entirety. It's in its entirety to work on it, but...
I've got to clear the workbench as well, so I've got somewhere to do it.
Right. I have to figure out how to paint. I want to find the paint for the switches too. But So I, while I'm waiting for that to be built by me, then I thought, well, you know, maybe it might be kind of nice to know what I was going to do with it once I actually got it assembled. But the real reason that I saw this PDP-AD simulator is that I subscribe to basically like a, you know, updates email from this particular one is at macupdate.com, and they, you know, they sort of like send you when various programs get updated. And I was surprised to see in the little list of things that the, you know, the PDP-8E simulator had reached version 2.02. I thought, oh, well, okay, I'll have to look at this. And, it's really quite cool. I don't think I've ever seen it before, but it's not a new piece of software, but it did just get updated, so that makes it kind of newsworthy. It's Mac OS X only, I think, but it has a number of different windows when you load it up. One of them is a really nice rendition of the front panel. Of course, when I do it on my 13-inch laptop, there's only space on the window for that, but there are also several other. There's a CPU window and a tape reader and a punch card reader, and so I managed to get the thing up and running and you know, read in a demo tape, and I think I managed to read in I typed in into the CPU kind of like a tape reader program, and then loaded in something, you know, like I kind of made it work, but it's really very pretty. It looks completely functional, and so I am hoping that I will have a chance to play around with this a little bit in preparation for having something to toggle.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So has anyone else seen this before?
Not this one, no. I've just gone and favorited it to my list.
And I don't have a Mac.
I'm quite impressed, actually. I mean, like, it looks very sort of professional. You know, everything seems to work, and to the extent that you can make such a machine uncomplicated, I think it does. It also says that it's Apple scriptable, which means that essentially you can write little scripts to run to command the simulator. So you could, I don't know. I mean, it's basically a machine, a Mac automation language that can communicate between applications and things. But the PDP-80 simulator can receive such commands as well. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, I will have to play with it more. But I was very impressed just even by the look.
Awesome. Well, next we have a couple of news items from Carrington that I'm not going to cover at all. And Carrington, if you ever decide to show up again, you can talk about these things. So let me see. Paul, you had mentioned that maybe you wanted to talk about one or two of the spares. Did you have anything that you wanted to cover before we went on to the other stuff?
Oh, well, maybe I will just go ahead and mention the one bit of news that just broke, I think, is that Bill Hurd has been, you know, recruited, confirmed as the narrator for the 8-bit generation documentary. So that's pretty cool. I forget now. At the link that we'll provide, it will say how long it is, but it's something, I think it's somewhere in the 90-minute range, the finished product.
That's great. And he has a great voice for that, too. That's just perfect.
What else has he done?
In terms of, he was on a 3-part episode of Retro Bits, I'll point out. And that went really well. In terms of, he has some of his own videos over on the C128 site. And also, he's got something on Hackaday, I think. Aren't there a handful of Hackaday videos that Bill Hurd goes through and teaches some electronic stuff?
Yeah, and he's, there's also a joint video series, I think it is, with Fran, you know, the Fran, electronics Fran Blanche.
Oh, okay.
Fran Blanche did, she for a while, I think, was working on, like, guitar effects and things, pedals and things, but she's a sort of like a video series on her own, but she and Bill Hurd have together been doing some kind of repeated endeavor, I think mainly about Commodore.
Neat. And you probably know this part, Ken, but Bill Hurd was the main designer behind the Commodore 128. So he's been around in the 8-bit computing world forever.
Right. I'm sorry. When he was mentioned as being the narrator, I was thinking of narrators like Richard Kiley and other voiceover actors. And
oh, right.
I wasn't thinking, of course he would be a Commodore engineer. That's who I would go to if I needed some way to do the narration for my documentary.
Well, you certainly wouldn't go to an Apple engineer.
Ouch. Okay. But no, of course, I mean, given the context, this makes perfect sense. And Paul, you were correct. The film is estimated to run about 87 minutes.
Excellent. So yeah, that was actually a longer mention than I had intended, that's enough. I'll save the rest for later. But it's good to see that the documentary is moving ahead.
Indeed, excited about that one. But now we're going to take a break for a word.
No.
From our sponsor.
No. Now, Timex brings the power of the computer within reach of more people than ever before. Introducing the Timex Sinclair 1000, the first of a new generation of computers designed to be easier to use and to own. For $99.95, power to learn at the speed of light, power to organize with unfailing accuracy. The Timex Sinclair 1000, the power is within your reach.
And we're back with a host's retro computing gift idea. You know, we try and think about things that people involved in technology would like, and there's such a strong correlation between technophiles and sci-fi lovers. With the new Star Wars Episode 7 coming out in December, I thought I had to pick something Star Wars. So I picked a R2-D2 mouse pad, and I just really love the perspective of R2-D2 on this mouse pad. It's just, I like the, well, I don't know if it's photography, if you're simulating something, but Anyway, I like the art of this, and it's only $5.50, so that's what I'm picking. What do you guys think?
It is nice. Do I have a mouse?
It's cute.
It's adorable.
There's the Darth Vader fan.
Well, you know who wins in the end, right, Michael? Yeah. I don't want to burst your bubble.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It was a sad. It was a sad ending.
Okay. So, eBay auctions. Paul, this is weird. You got more than one. Why don't you tell us about what you got here for eBay?
Okay. So let's see. Oops. No, it went away. Where is it?
No, eBay's still there.
Yes. Hooray. Right. Okay. So the first one I have is an Osborne OCC2 executive. So this is the second attempt of Osborne in the portable computing range. It really looks a lot like the first one, OCC1, but it's, I think the screen is a little bigger. There's a couple of differences, but actually I don't know what the differences are now that I think about it. But the screen is bigger. At any rate, I've seen a couple of these go by. For some reason, everybody's unloading their OCC2s now, so I thought I would point to one that doesn't seem like it's overly expensive. This one is starting at $110. For me, shipping from Las Vegas is $65, and this one seems like it's in pretty nice shape. They show it working, and it has all the keys. And it actually has a nice little carrying bag, and it has folders with disks in them. It's one of the more complete sets I've seen. The only thing that I can really see that's wrong with it that you can't fix by just cleaning it is that the handle seems to have broken a bit. There's a kind of like a, I don't know, plastic/leather kind of thing that you use to carry it around with, and that needs replacing. But this actually does not seem like a terrible price for this. So
handle notwithstanding, I'd jump at this one if it wasn't going to cost a fortune to get it down here.
I think it is a reasonable price. Here's the only thing that I notice about this one. They say working, but the only thing that they show is the initial boot-up screen.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't show it actually having been booted from a floppy disk. And the reason that distinction registers with me is I had a K-Pro, and it came up and it gave the insert disk prompt. The monitor was working, but the floppy drives were shot, and I could never quite get there. It wasn't just a matter of they needed cleaning. They were pretty much gone. So that's the only thing I'd be suspicious on this one, is whether or not it actually boots up into CPM.
Yeah, that's and of course, I mean, this was kind of like a great leap forward in terms of, you know, actually somebody showing that the screen worked. Usually you don't even get that, but it's true. I also have a K-Pro 2 that was doing. It's very intermittent. I think I've gotten to the CPM prompt before, but often it just sits at the insert disk prompt. So let's see, another one I have. A TRS-80 Model 1 and monitor with cases. So I thought this was interesting primarily because of the cases. I don't think they're Radio Shack specific. Maybe they are. But they're form fit for the computer. So there's a one case that the Model 1 computer goes into, and then there's another sort of deep case that the monitor, Radio Shack themed monitor goes into. This is not super cheap, but it doesn't seem crazy. The bid starts at $150, and everything looks clean. It does start up. I mean, so it's we see print mem on the monitor, so not bad.
Yeah, I don't think that's crazy for a working Model 1 with the monitor. You know, so often you see the Model 1s, but the monitors are tougher to come by.
It makes me a little scared to have them shipped, but nevertheless.
Yes.
Let's see, what else? There is a Hero Junior. So I keep my eye out for these Hero robots, and I've seen a couple. The Hero Junior is a smaller one than the Hero 1, which is the one I am usually looking for, but this does not seem to bad. It looks pretty clean. They're small, which I think I actually kind of like in a way, because they don't take up as much space, kind of by definition. But so this is it's a $200 thing with a, to me, $75 shipping. But it looks like it's in good shape. If you're in the market for such a robot, or even if you just want to look at the pictures, that's mainly what we're doing here, is showing people pictures. Okay, I'll close off with the most ridiculous Mac Mini case I have ever seen, which is it is a walnut Macintosh 128K replica, but with a Mac Mini inside. So through the floppy, the you know, sort of like floppy drive, you can put in a CD or a DVD, I suppose. But it is walnut. It's got a gold plated keys, but I think it is a working computer. The starting bid is $10,000. So you can go look at the pictures, but I anticipate this will continue to be listed for many weeks to come.
Yeah, at least it's affordable.
Yeah.
Wow. That's about the cost of a Lisa.
Yeah.
When it first came out.
It looks very nice.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Actually, the workmanship there is noteworthy. But the price, oof.
Mm. Now, I must admit, the workmanship is quite nice. I'm not a fan of walnut as far as the color goes, but it is beautiful. I love the keyboard, the gold. I'm sure it's just painted.
No, I don't think it is. It actually says it's Blue Cherry MX tactile switches.
Yep, gold-plated keycaps. On gold-plated zinc keycaps. Oh, okay. I like.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it can come in sort of like a more a blonder style wood, or maybe ash or something along those lines.
My guess is that there aren't a lot of these out there to choose from.
Oh, I think this might be the one.
Yep. It's cool, though.
It is very cool.
So my auction thing is not nearly as exciting as that. But here's the cool part about it. Up for auction is a 32K memory expansion card for the Texas Instruments 99/4A. This is one of those cards that you would put in the peripheral expander. Now, a show or two back, we had an eBay auction featured with one of the peripheral boxes for the 99/4 that was in stellar condition, and I think being sold for a reasonable price. I'm not sure whatever became of that auction, but if you were the lucky winner, or if you have one of those boxes that isn't populated, then here's a 32K RAM expansion card for it, and by the same seller, there are a number of other cards that are being auctioned as well. So if you've got one of the peripheral expansion units and it's time to fill up that bad boy with some major peripheral expansion, then you need to get over to eBay right now and take a look. The seller here has, don't look at that memory expansion card because that already ended. I just noticed the best offer was accepted and it's gone.
There is an RS-232 card.
Yeah, this is the seller for these has 100% positive feedback. And I'm just checking under the items for sale here whether any of the rest of these are left. Some are and some aren't. Wow. Okay. Well, I take it back.
You must move faster, listeners.
That was, yeah. You have to basically buy it before you hear the podcast. Michael, is your item still for sale?
I've just confirmed that my item still has time left to sell. So, has gone up to three bids. So, if you're interested in an Amstrad PPC 640, there is one that's in fairly good condition. It's another early implementation of the portable computing, if you can call 6 kilos. I think it was about 6 kilos. These boys, when they're fully loaded with 10 C cells, for that 1 hour of mobile computing experience on a poorly contrasting LCD screen. But it's another one of these weird shapes. I actually quite like PPC 640. So you can plug it into an external monitor, but you do have a tilt-adjustable LCD in there, dual floppy drives. It's quite a nice machine, and is, as I said, it's an auction, so it's going to sell.
Have you guys seen one of these in person? I had the chance to see one of these at the Seattle Retro Computing Society meeting. Huh. And also, I think that there was one on sale at one of the classic, or the Portland Retro Gaming Expos that I went to. Funny enough, there was one of these there. It's a really kind of fun-looking machine.
Mm. Yeah, I would love to have one. I saw one for sale maybe half a year ago or something. That wasn't too far away from me, but it was just a little bit more than I was ready to go for. I would really not mind having a chance to play around with them. I really like the way they look.
Yeah, it's a cool looking machine.
Yeah, I quite like the all the different ways that they were looking at how to create portable computers to sort of not necessarily to use, you know, on a train or something like that. Though this one could, with the 10 C cells popped into the battery bay. And that, speaking of that, that is the only flaw that I can see on this one here. I believe that it no longer has the cover for the battery tray at the back underneath. But that's just that can be fixed with someone who is skillful in the arts of 3D printing, I suppose, or a little bit of gaffer tape, or just sit it there on your desk and use it. It's a nice little DOS machine. So if you're down under, this might be a good addition to your collection.
The price right now is showing, with the exchange rate, about $7.39 US.
Yep. So $10.50 Australian. Yep.
It's very reasonable. It says may not ship to United States, so it's a down under kind of purchase. Let us know if you get hold of this, Michael.
I'm tempted, but I'll defer to any of our listeners. So if you're after this, send us something to RCR Podcast and tell Michael to go away. Leave it alone.
Yep, it's got 8 days left. We'll see if we're published. All right, so we're through the eBay. Now we're into the closing discussions. Normally here I would ask Carrington if he had any parting shots, but Carrington's not here, so he doesn't get that opportunity. There seems to be a running theme here with all the things that are labeled Carrington. Hello. So instead I'll ask the people who are here. Michael, any parting shots for us?
Well, mine is actually more interesting coming after yours, but I will preempt you. Just for something different, I'm currently doing an online course with Coursera, a wonderful online free university learning system, and I'm actually doing Roman architecture at the moment.
Wow, that's awesome.
Are you learning how to make it?
Well, funnily enough, the final assessment item is to submit a Roman town plan. So I suppose I'm going to be a town planner of such. There's been, you know, just the typical written exercises on different styles and the multiple choice question one was not exactly what I call simple, but it's interesting. I've done a few through Coursera, and I just thought I'd do something that was away from technology, but also still in one of my other non-computing, non-tech interests, which is Roman history, and in particular Roman architecture.
I think that's excellent. That's exciting. Cool stuff. So what about you, Paul? What have you concluded from all this?
Well, I guess there's not a whole lot that's sort of happening here. Mostly just I'm just drowning in all this stuff I'm having to go through. It's a lot of fun to go through these things, but it doesn't make for very interesting reports. I'm just kind of making my way through my collection, trying to at least figure out where everything is.
Ah, gotcha. So yeah, that's a good thing to do. I need to do that too, actually.
It is
most of my stuff is where I can see it, but
It is so it's so frustrating when you know, you think, oh, okay, I need, you know, like, I need this cable.
Right.
It's like, okay,
and then you discover
saw this.
I had one.
Oh, I know, I have one. I saw it 4 months ago, and I don't know where it is. But so that's actually often that has worked relatively well for me. It's just if I can remember kind of how long ago it was since I saw it, I can kind of identify what stratum it's in.
It's like the rings on a tree.
Right,
yeah. You know how deep to dig.
Yeah, it's the sedimentary filing system.
Right.
Oh, that's good. So what about you, Ken? What would you say in closing?
I would say that I am a sad camper right now because I just switched jobs and I've been downgraded from an office at the old job to a cubicle at the new one, and it's even at that, a temporary cubicle. They're going to be moving me around in the next few months, which means in the meantime, I don't have anywhere to put my Apple IIgs.
Oh.
Yeah, it was a nice set piece in my old office. It was unmistakable and unavoidable. People would walk right into my office and say, "Oh my God, what is that?" Or, "I haven't seen one of those in years." Or, "Does that still work?" Or, "Can I play Oregon Trail?" And now it's nowhere to be seen because I like having it in my office at my day job as opposed to set up at home. Granted, there's a lot more I could do with that at home, but I like having it right there Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. It makes the day job a little more tolerable to know that I can just escape into retro computing at a moment's notice if I need to. And I was thinking, I think it was on a recent episode of RCR that we were talking about in the old days, people would actually have like covers and hoods for their computer, kind of like they used to do for typewriters. And I'm thinking, like, I need to get one for my Apple IIgs because it is temporarily on a table in my basement. And I want to protect it until it can find a new home next to the window in my new cubicle. So in the meantime, it's not going to be getting much use, I'm sad to say.
Well, we will cross our fingers that that situation gets resolved ASAP. 2GS without a home, that's just, it is, it's sad.
I know, right? I mean, I should have negotiated that in the interview process. I'm like, okay, you know, like I understand that the benefits and salary are very attractive, and that's a good reason for me to move, but what can you do for my Apple II?
I think that would have got you to the job right there, but you got the job anyway. So
I did, for better or for worse. There I am.
Yep. And I guess in closing, I'll say I'm also taking a course on Coursera. It's nothing as enlightening, I think, as what Michael's doing with Roman architecture, but I am learning about a different kind of architecture, software architecture, as it turns out. This is a course on software security, trying to keep the bad guys from exploiting all those naughty SQL injections or buffer overflows or things of that nature.
Keep the Visigoths out of those outer suburbs.
Yes. And it's actually been pretty fun in that for a couple of the labs, you put together an exploit and actually try and run it against a virtualized environment to do things like punch through the buffers or hack the sample website that they have for you and get all those fake credit card numbers out of it. So, and I just think it's a brave new world. We can take these university courses for free from centers of excellence around the world. It's just, anyway, it's a neat thing. So that's how I'll close us out on a high note. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. We can be discussed in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. I always mention this, whether you're there to talk about the retro podcasts or just there to hang out with the retro community, the Vintage Computer Forums is a good place to go do it. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we tweet. Yes, we do. And we tweet at RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, aptly named. We're a member of the Throwback Network. No, that doesn't mean you can throw us back. But if you're interested in retro-type things, not just computers, but other vintage-type activities, throwbacknetwork.net is a fun place to go find that stuff. And if you like us, write a review over on iTunes. We appreciate it. And until next time,
Retro Compute.